In so many elections, one after the other, we see something going on. The political center is shrinking and the right wing and the left wing are taking over. In this episode, we're going to discuss what happened to the political center. It's why it matters. Let's do it on The Public Diplomat. Hey, guy.
Morning.
When Bill Clinton ran for office in 1992, I think I was in college. This was my big political moment. This was my candidate. Bill Clinton came and he offered us Americans a new type of politics. He is going to be the new Democrat, the Democrat who governs from the center. This same campaign message was heard in England a few years earlier with Tony Blair. Ran the same election message in Ehud Barak's 1999 prime ministerial election in Israel. So the message is simple. We're going to move to the center, and we're going to get the people in the center to bring our politicians to power.
Less ideological, more pragmatic.
Pragmatic. Let's all work together. Let's unite the country, and let's make government work for the people. But as we look at trends from the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, even 30 years, we see something interesting that's happening. The political center is shrinking. Where is it going?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the chart that you see on the screen now, you see exactly what you're talking about. The middle voters, the ones that ideologically or on policy issues can go to either party, is becoming smaller and smaller as the major blocks of voters of both parties are moving to the right and left. And what's interesting that you can see here on this chart is you can see that in this move from the center to the extremes to the poles, the left has moved farther along than the right. The right has moved, if you look at the numbers, mm-hmm. from the median right from the measure of six to 6.5 over, 20 years or so? And the median Democrat on issues moved from 5 to 2.5. Okay, and so what you have here is this change in the voter behavior. And I think when you look into the numbers more closely socioeconomically, if you think this is a negative development and you want to blame someone, blame the highly educated, socioeconomically wealthier, because they're the ones who are moving in both parties.
We're going to talk about this all day today. Let's talk about a little bit of real life political science, right? When people run campaigns, there are always two competing theories. The first theory is the Bill Clinton theory, the New Democrat theory, which says, look, you know, the people on the right are going to vote Republican or conservative all around the world, no matter which country. The people on the left will vote for the left. And in order to tip the balance, especially when you have close elections, you're going to say, my voter is going to vote for me anyways. Let's grab the people in the center, the undecided, the swing voter, et cetera. That's the first theory in political science and in real-life political campaigning. Can you talk about the second one, which is the opposite one?
Yeah, so that theory, if you look at that chart, fits an electorate that has a large middle. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's a large group. You want to get a good share of it. The opposing strategy is one that is associated, I don't know if it's true, but certainly associated with Karl Rove's kind of innovative or at the time novel approach to politics, and that is forget the center, forget that swing voter. What you want to do in order to win elections is energize your base, get your base, which is, again, if you look at this chart, as the middle shrinks, the non-middle, the polls, increase. And so if you can get those voters to the voting place, you're going to win elections.
Right. So, I mean, this discussion is as relevant to the conversation as ever. Let's talk about the facts, where we are right now in the world. Because we just covered the election in Colombia, where we had a left-wing candidate from the far left beat over a populist right winger. The political center in Colombia kind of disappeared. Emmanuel Macron in France is unable right now, as we speak, to form a coalition government because in the regional election, his centrist party got shellacked at the expense of, being beaten by right-wing Marine Le Pen's and also the far left. And we see this in every election after the other. And now as we head to the American midterm elections, again, we see a nation divided. So let's talk about the causes. What do you think is... Well, let's talk about the facts, first of all, and then we'll talk about the causes.
Well, so look, the facts are, again, what the statistics reveal. Okay, the people are moving. That's incontestable. What is contestable is who's responsible.
Okay? All right, so let's talk about that.
And so... The one culprit is the political strategist, okay? The party election managers who, according to this theory, they're to blame because they are poking the electorate, their base, they're exciting them, they're inflaming them, they're radicalizing them, and the result is what we have.
And they're spent, in your theory, they're spending money to promote political campaign ads, to talk about wedge issues from both sides of the aisle.
And demonizing the other side. And so they are the ones who are inflaming the emotions of the electorate, and the poor electorate is being manipulated, and now they're inflamed. Okay, so
That's theory number one. Theory number two has to do with the changing. I mean, if you really look at what is so different about 1994 than today, I'm going to say, and again, it's my bias as a media professor, I'm going to say that the media environment has changed completely in two major developments. One is media fragmentation, and the second is empowerment of the ordinary citizen to engage in the conversation through social media channels, or platforms. So let's talk about the first one, okay? Back in the day, when our folks grew up, they would watch, one TV show. Right,
one half hour of news.
One half hour of news. Yeah. ABC, CBS, NBC, Cronkite. Right, I mean, it was everybody watched the same channel, and you didn't get too much in terms of politics. It was very superficial, and it was quote unquote unbiased, semi-objective. Then we see the rise of cable, fragmentation of media channels over the last 20 years, where today you see channels such as Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire, right? Beating up ratings-wise on all the evening news shows or vice versa from the left, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so look, the result is that when we complain about polarization, what we're really, without knowing it, complaining about is that the public that's interested in politics is more knowledgeable because there are so many venues that give you knowledge about politics. Like you said, before you had half an hour that covered everything. Now you have 24 hours on innumerable outlets that tell you about all sorts of inside baseball about foreign policy and domestic policy and deals in Washington and deals in your state house. So voters who care about politics know a lot more
about how the sausage is made.
Exactly.
But let's talk about how it's framed, because how the sausage has been made and is made all around the world, especially in governments and countries where you have coalition systems, right? And so the European coalition systems that are throughout the world, politicians make deals with people they disagree with because that's how government actually works, right? So we call it bipartisanship. That's a fancy term for it. And in the good old days, back in the day, if you want to call it that, the notion of somebody being bipartisan and working with people across the aisle was framed in a positive manner as somebody who can actually make government work for the people. Nowadays, when the word bipartisanship turned into a four-letter words almost, right? I mean, if you are working with somebody on the other side, you're not an effective politician. You're a traitor to the cause.
Right, but I would say that the reason why it's become an epithet and used to be celebrated is because people didn't know about, didn't see the sausage, okay? And so you're tuning in once, twice, three times a week to watch half an hour of TV news or reading the newspaper are presented with a solution, a compromise, and you didn't even know what the two starting positions were. So you're just handed a final product, and you're told that both sides approve of it. Okay, so fine, so you trust. Okay. If you're a knowledgeable voter, or citizen, you know what your side really wanted. So when you see the final product, you know, hey, this falls really short of what I wanted. He sold me out. Okay, so again, and what I said earlier about knowledgeable voters being engaged voters, this has, again, been studied sociologically or surveyed, that the most knowledgeable audiences about civics and about politics are the John Stewart, Rachel Maddow audiences on the left and the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity audiences on the right. And so these are populations that know their stuff, and the result, going back to the strategy of how you win election, is if you choose strategically to go after the middle voter who doesn't know much and isn't very engaged in politics, you might get that voter. But you will disappoint at least one or two or three voters who are usually reliable voters for you.
So let's give an example from American politics. When Mitt Romney ran against Barack Obama, he was supposed to be the centrist candidate who will bring people from the other side of the aisle. But in your worldview, the opposite actually happened.
Right. In terms of surveys, it showed that people agreed with his policies, but the conservative base didn't show up to vote for him. Partly it's because, you know, Mitt Romney is not the most vigorous, inspiring person, but also because people got the sense, as we see correctly since then, that he really is leaning towards the middle, and he's not committed to the values of the base.
Okay, and let's chart on with the fact that if you look at who is the most active in terms of political engagement, it is the people on the right and on the left, and not the people in the center.
Right. The people in the center are those, you know, Reagan Democrats who swing from this candidate to that candidate, because they're not, again, I'm not talking about you who happen to be
watching or listening.
Who happen to be in the middle and are engaged and are knowledgeable about politics. But statistically, we can see that the people who are less educated, less engaged politically, are and less knowledgeable about politics and civics are the most likely to swing. Whereas the population that is most entrenched is upper middle class, very knowledgeable about politics and civics, and they're the ones who occupy the liberal, the progressive left, and the Tea Party wing of the Christian conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Okay, but let's talk about what social media also did to this dynamic, because, I mean, it didn't happen in a vacuum. What we have here with social media platforms is the absolute emergence of echo chambers, where if you go on your social media, most people only will follow news outlets and other accounts that confirm their worldview. We call this confirmation bias, right? So whenever we go and there's something happening in international politics, domestic politics, we are going to search for content that confirms our worldview in order to give us a sense of certainty. And we're not going to be reaching across the aisle all that much in terms of information seeking. But there's one more thing, Guy, before you jump in. There's another phenomenon that's relatively new, and we'll talk about its consequences pretty soon, and that is we not only follow people on Twitter or Instagram or TikTok, whatever the kids are into these days, we see now a new phenomenon, and that is we do not socialize with people who disagree with us politically. So if once upon a time, before social media, people used to work together, hang out together, go to happy hour together with people who had different political views. Nowadays, with the exception of the occasional crazy uncle during Thanksgiving, it's very, very likely to see that Americans, right, will not really know other people, not really hang out with people who disagree with them politically.
So it's partly social media, it's exacerbated by social media, but it happened beforehand by geographic relocation. You know, Americans have become more and more mobile between cities and states, but also within cities. And so I'm assuming it has to do with real estate, realtor technology, and with a variety of other things that people are have a better sense of what part of town or what town they'd like to live in, and they wind up living with people who are like them sociologically, and therefore share their, more likely to share their worldview. And then when you take that to cyberspace, to video gaming, and to podcasts,
metaverse, mm-hmm.
you pursue the same thing. You look for people like you, as we all do.
Yeah, it's kind of human nature, but it has social implications in many ways. Yeah.
Oh, and the thing about social media and election politics, electioneering, is that I think we talk about this in a complaining tone again about the polarization, and we forget that the polarization is the result of something that is laudatory, and that is people caring about politics, knowing about politics, and being educated. By the same token, this lament about the wedge issues and you know, demonizing the other side and everything else, again, it's the product of, I think, something that we would usually celebrate, the fact that people care about. Of course, the economy is important, and tax, marginal taxes, etc. But most people on the left and right, it turns out, care a lot more about the social issues, the cultural issues, the values issues, etc. And what social media does is it allows people to get content that they really care about. And so the nightly news might tell you about the tax policies of this candidate and that, but your social media will tell you their attitudes about guns and women and transgender.
Oh, hold on. But the social media platforms and the narrative in social media, you know, Twitter is a complete dumpster fire, right? I mean, it not only tells us the details and facts about gun control, right, or about gay marriage or about whatever wedge issue is in the news these days, it also does something that's very severe. And it tells us who is the in-group and who is the out-group. And it colors the out-group in very negative tones, which has real implications for any society, right? Because, I mean, again, I want to go back to European politics. Mm-hmm. European politics, as we see right now with Macron in France, you need to govern through the center. You need to govern through compromise. You need to govern with people who disagree with you. And in order to make any government successful, and we see what's happening in Israel. Israel is going to a fifth election within 4 years, I believe, right? Because the two sides of the aisle can't find a way together. And a lot of it has to do not only with ideological differences, and we'll cover Israel in a different episode, but it has to do with how people view the people on the other side of the aisle, right? So, I mean, there is a very simple question to be asked in any living room, anybody's listening right now, and that is, if you ask people if they voted for and against Donald Trump, right, that the answer to that question will have more implication on friendships, on relationships, on professional relationships than any other question in American politics today, okay? Because what we have from both sides of the aisle is an absolutist worldview that if you disagree with me on this one important issue, and it's a very important issue to many people, then I do not want to have anything to do with you. This is dangerous for democracy. We need to work together on both sides of the aisle.
Let me counter that. Look, when the news media, again, I don't think that the news media colluded to keep the wedge issues down. It's just that people who are kind of inside politics, they really do care about foreign policy and the tax rates and the economy, okay? And of course, people like us, voters, do care about the economy, but their behavior on social media and their behavior interpersonally indicates daily that as important as the economy is, all sorts of moral and values issues are more important, just like in your family life. Look, your family's economy is important to you, but it's much more important how your kids treat your their grandparents, and how, you know, that they're not violent. All sorts of values issues are much more important to people, and so people are seek out information about the other side's values to see what kind of and it reveals what kind of people they are. So all of politics, you're right, has become more moral or moralistic, which again, if you take away the inability to make deals in smoke-filled rooms, you'd think that that's a good thing, you know, that they know more and care more about than simply dollars and cents. Yeah, so this is the consequence, and maybe it means that we're going to have a new kind of politics.
Well, you know, the thing about the United States that's different than most other electoral systems around the world, right? That is that our entire political process is based on compromise and the inability to pass any legislation, right? So Barack Obama is elected. He has a majority in the House and the Senate.
Supermajorities.
Yeah. Supermajorities, and he's completely unable to pass Obamacare in its original form. Our system is set up for bipartisanship. Our system is set up for compromise. Our system is set up to reward a Joe Manchin much more than it is to reward an AOC or somebody from the Trump estate.
I disagree.
Go for it.
Our system is designed to make passing legislation very difficult.
Yes.
So that if you manage to pass a law, again, theoretically, the way it's set up, it means that it is so far, has such a broad consensus agreement that even in a system geared to prevent legislation, you can get it passed. For example, passing a legislation to make Tuesday apple pie day. You'll get that passed, okay? But anything that's even close to controversial,
pecan pie. Yeah.
Yeah. it's not going to get passed, and the result will be that you know your state will pass it, but not federally. And so, look, a lot of people, and again, this is a partisan perception issue. People on the right, people on the left, do complain about gridlock. Nothing can get passed. People on the right say this is gridlock, but it's supposed to be gridlock. Because we our forefathers, the founding fathers, were afraid of the central government, the federal government, passing laws and policies, and so maybe this is not something to complain about, this lack of cooperation, but something to, again, if you have that view of society, of the government, something to celebrate that, thank goodness, the people know more and therefore are more punishing of people who dare to compromise. And the result is that nothing gets passed and people govern themselves locally rather than nationally.
Interesting. Well, do you think the two sides understand one another?
I'd say it this way. I think conservatives, people on the right, know and understand people on the left because we all live, like if you go to the movies, if you go to college, if you watch any cable news show or news channel or network news channel other than Fox News, if you listen to pop music, if you just live in America, you're going to be exposed, with or without trying, to the left wing's understanding of human nature, foreign policy, politics, etc. By contrast, if you want to, in order to be exposed to the conservative view of sex, human nature, politics, foreign policy, whatever, the economy, you have to not just live in America and have stuff, the culture around you, you have to go and seek out, which channel is Fox News? Go to the Wall Street Journal rather than all the other newspapers. So I think people on the left, just a few weeks ago, Bill Maher, who works in the news industry, he should know stuff about the news. He said that he was surprised. He didn't know that most pro-lifers were women. Okay, and he didn't know that Europe had more conservative policies on abortion than the U.S. He didn't know that virtually that 90%+ of mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. So again, this is a guy who works in the news, and he didn't know things that you would find on the Wall Street Journal regularly. Okay, so I think there's an asymmetry there.
Okay, as people, we hear a lot about the upcoming civil war, the terror in America, right? And I want to remind everybody that we've heard this tune before. I mean, we did have a civil war here in the United States back in the day. I mean, there's so much conversation about the fact that we delegitimize the other side of the aisle. The political center is not celebrated, but it's punished, right? And this is going to lead to a real tension within a people. But we've had the Vietnam War. We've had, you know, the civil rights movement and all the controversies. Yeah,
the busing riots, the race riots in the 60s, the Richard Nixon with the all the kind of images of him as a Hitler. And FDR, you know, even more so, LBJ. So I think we had this spate of political assassinations. So I think we really do romanticize the past because perhaps we remember or we're told, we're shown national emergencies of the past, World War II, September 11th, et cetera, and how the nation came together. And that's our image of the past, especially those of us who didn't live through it, which most of us did not. And so we have this image of the past as unity, and we live through dissension, when in fact, people who are older than us and know more than us will look at you and say, what are you talking about? We hated each other in the past. We vilified each other. We called each other Nazis, et cetera, and fascists. So I think it's a bit overwrought.
Well, let me romanticize the notion of the center. Let me take 10 seconds and make the case for the political center.
Before you do, yeah. One other thing about this romantic view of the past. We need to also remember that the hallmark of a free society is this: if you believe that people are different, we're going to disagree. And in a free society, you get to express that disagreement, and it's going to inflame the other side.
Hold on. I'm going to pause you right here. This is the number one issue in America today. We no longer have a free and open marketplace of ideas. What we have are two different channels with two different audiences who don't necessarily speak to one another. And if you disagree with me, I'll challenge you and ask you, when's the last time you saw a conservative thinker on a college campus on the one side, right?
I saw one chased out just a few weeks ago.
and the other one is, when's the last time you saw a liberal speaker come to a community of faith, for example, right? So, I mean, differences are not celebrated. The marketplace of ideas is under attack, whether it's a function of pure ratings, because the political center is not all that interesting, right? It doesn't bring the ratings. This is a different question, but ultimately, in order to govern, especially in coalition systems, especially also in the United States, with its hard to able to legislate anything, I'm going to argue that the political center has a major function. Are we going to see the center disappear or reemerge? Only time will tell. But I think this is an interesting conversation that's definitely worth consideration. For Guy and me, thank you all for watching, and we hope to see you soon on The Public Diplomat. If you have not done so yet, please subscribe, like, share, and do all those awesome things. Have a good one.